That's noise. What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
We're at the circulation. What we need is fireworks. People are going to hit with sledgehammers. Start arguments.
Oh, I can do that. I know this town inside out.
It's the Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. Some folks who know this town inside out. Joni Balter, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders in the studios with us to talk about the news of the week. That was a Barbara Stanwyck clip from Meet John Doe, where the newspaper manufactures a hero, and then he becomes a whole social movement. I think we're doing
that. Those clips are getting better every single
I think movie. We can. And you know, it's part of the same theme. I wanted to start with Boeing and what happened with Boeing and some of the coverage that we've seen of late. And what I thought was interesting as it's developed is this union rift. We talked about it a little bit last week, but we heard even more about it today. The leadership, the national leadership versus, or the international leadership versus the local leadership. What context does that give you to the Boeing machinist vote?
Well, when you have folks come in from out of state, and you've seen this with some other labor unrest where the nationals come in, they sort of take the thing over, and then some of the folks who are here are left feeling at the very least confused. What I thought was so interesting about this week, there was so much back and forth and second guessing about, you know, so the machinists took this vote. Were they right? Were they wrong? There was a poll that said most people, 56% to be exact, feel that the machinists made a mistake. There were many folks coming back at the argument that was made here last week about the race to the bottom. There was a Bruce Ramsey column in which he talked about that they're not even within light years of the bottom, and just this whole sort of, okay, the vote was taken, and now we are having this gut-wrenching discussion about how it ripped the union apart, how the union's divided, and how the community's divided. The one thought I have that I think is very important is that I'm not sure if the governor is working to find another way to settle this. Even though he did his part, he and the legislature did the part according to Boeing, it still falls on the shoulders of a governor to come up with the next plan.
Well, he talked about how he was rolling up his sleeves and now we're just going to get more competitive. Eli, what did you think about that poll, the Elway poll? 56% of state residents said they would have voted to approve the contract. Easy for them to say, of course, for all of us, compared to 31% who said they would have voted no. I'm curious about the 31% and what that tells us about where we are.
Well, I think you're exactly right. It's easy for people who are not in the machinist's shoes to say. And also, I think a lot of people, when they look at the machinist's contract and benefits, think, wow, that's pretty good. That's better than I've got. A lot of journalists say that. So it's easy to let a kind of relative jealousy overwhelm the instinct against a kind of collective race to the bottom where you say, well, they should give that up and don't realize that in the long run it doesn't benefit any worker in the state for that to happen.
You know, it was interesting, Danny Westneat's column, he quoted in the Seattle Times, he quoted one machinist who said it was like being kneecapped by someone you thought was your friend. He was referring to Jay Inslee and Patty Murray. I don't know if they meant to, but they hung us out to dry. What did you think of that?
I thought the quote in Danny's column was very revealing, because I think the machinists see that the state is ponying up $8 or $9 billion in subsidies. Boeing is making record profits, yet they're the ones being asked to make the sacrifice. They're the guys who build the planes, and so I think from their perspective, it's kind of a matter of equity. Is there some sort of shared sacrifice here? Is there some sort of the other thing is that I think there's a divide in the Democratic Party. And you saw this in WTO, if you go back, because you had Bill Clinton on one side and the Teamsters on another. You had unions who were opposed to free trade. You had the mainstream of the Democratic Party being pro-free trade much more working with big corporations. And in this state, the Democratic mainstream is in Boeing's camp. They want those jobs. And there are times when, you know, business and labor disagree. And I think liberal Democrats like Patty Murray and Jay Inslee have a tough line to walk there, because there is an issue when it comes down to these things of whose side are you on.
So the squeeze play that people are talking about, and they're pointing at Boeing as being hit with that squeeze play, even though they're much higher paid workers than the people who are affected by the $15 an hour minimum wage. So that spectrum from Boeing to the person who's hoping to get $15 for a minimum wage, is there common ground for there to be a movement?
Well, here's where there was common ground. The common ground was the concern about the middle class and maybe down a little bit. And, you know, this issue that came up with fairness was interesting, because I wonder, so if the executives of Boeing had cut their own retirement package in half, and even though it's this big number, would that have changed the vote because we're all sharing in this? It's hard to know that. It's hard to know if you said this guy who's way up here is going to take a big cut, if that would really, really seem enough like a cut to appeal to this group. The other interesting thing that happened this week in regards to that, there was even some statement that our credit rating, the state of Washington's credit rating, could go lower if Boeing really follows through and does not build the airplane here.
Yeah. Do you think is there follow-up on that, Eli, that notion of common ground?
Well, I think the more people like the Boeing workers get squeezed and the more the middle class gets squeezed, the more likely there is to be a movement. You're talking about people on the high end of the middle class, upper middle class, when you're talking about Boeing workers. And when you're talking about people arguing for $15 an hour minimum wage, you're talking about people on the lower end of the middle class. And these ends of that spectrum don't always work together. But when they both start to feel squeezed and abandoned by both political leaders and the bosses that they work for, yeah, I think there is greater likelihood of a common movement.
And yet we saw a scramble, a wooing, the courting starting by states, governors, business interests all over the country. Everybody wants that job. And that means we lose those jobs.
Well, that's right. And I think analysts have said that the aerospace industry in this country is moving to the southeast, that the Carolinas, Texas, Alabama. I mean, it's always had a strong presence in aerospace because of NASA. But I think there's a sense that the Northwest is no longer uniquely positioned because of Boeing and the history we have in aerospace to continue being that. Other states would like to have those jobs. They'd like to have, whatever tax revenues. And there is a different competitive landscape. There's also an international competitive landscape, too, which is, you know, Boeing knows that China is going to be building its own jets pretty soon. So,
That was their argument, in fact, that they are competing in Boeing. They are competing in a different marketplace. They have to get the cost of the planes down as low as they can go. It seems like they didn't anticipate the reaction that they got, that's for sure. And I just wanted to add that the new city council member, Shama Sawant, sort of merged the two groups as well when she went to a machinist rally and, as she might do, said, you know, you guys should take over the Boeing plants. There's an idea. And it's sort of bringing some of her arguments about $15 and merging it right there at that rally with the machinist.
The only response we can have if Boeing executives do not agree to keep the plant here is for the machinist to say the machines are here, the workers are here, we will do the job, we don't need the executives.
We got that from Cairo 7 because they were there. Eli, you were going to say?
Well, what we were talking about a moment ago, the trend potentially of aerospace work moving to the Southwest, one thing that it leaves out is the expertise of the workers here. There is still fundamentally an advantage in the Northwest in terms of the expertise of the workers, and you saw that with Boeing's problems building jets elsewhere. And so I don't think that can be overlooked. There are also a lot of other built-in advantages of building jets here as opposed to, say, landlocked places in the middle of Texas. But what Shama Sawant is saying essentially is, look at the expertise that we have here. Look at the collective knowledge that we have among these workers. And I think her idea is somewhat fantastical, but she is. It makes the point. There is a lot of capability here that is potentially being abandoned, and it could be redirected.
Well, people like Shama Sawant, people like Danny Westing at the Times and David Goldstein at The Stranger, they're arguing that what we're seeing here is finally, after all this deconstruction, a shift to the left and the end of the Gilded Age. If we're in the second Gilded Age, we're seeing the end of it. Do you think, can we make that brash a statement?
I don't think we can say that we're seeing the end of it, but I wrote a piece this week about a talk that James Fallows gave when he was in Seattle recently, and his optimistic view was, that we are in a second Gilded Age, but that it's likely to end like the first Gilded Age did, with a lot of citizen reform. And if you think about what happened in the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, you had, women's suffrage, direct election of senators, initiatives, recalls, environmental protections, help for the poor. A lot of the things that were amplified later in the New Deal and other programs came about in a period of citizen reaction to income disparity. So our democracy came out of it stronger than when it went into it. And I think that regardless of what you think about Shama Sawant now, it's part of, I think, a ferment and turmoil that is being stirred up that relates to, whether it's Wall Street or the power of companies like Boeing, et cetera, is being stirred up. And I think there will be a reaction to that.
Well, it kind of depends on what you mean by gilded here, because if you think about it, what's been silent in all of this, we have a booming high-tech industry here. And one of the clips that we read for today talked about how all these tech companies are hiring, and they're hiring lots of people, and they are not paying low wages. They are paying very solid, good wages. And sort of the aerospace part of our economy has been sort of quiet in all this, and we just sort of assume it's there and it's quiet.
And still the divide between the wealthiest 1% and the rest of us in our country is incredible and starker than it's been in a very long time, and draws accurate comparisons to the Gilded Age. And I think in terms of change and openings for activism, what Goldie and a lot of other people have said is that the election of Shama Sawant allows – it kind of pulls the debate to the left in a way that allows ideas that might have been labeled or tagged as too far left before to seem centrist. When she's talking about essentially nationalizing the Boeing plants and letting the workers decide to build mass transit, which is what she's saying, if I understand her right – other proposals begin to seem more modest by comparison that might have been tagged as radical before. And I think there's a very useful opening that emerges there.
I think that one thing is that it's almost there's a generational split, because it used to be that you could get what you wanted and make most people happy by simply putting together a huge package that was part federal pork and part tax increases. Part of it has to do with the fact that the federal resources aren't as great. And it used to be that the center was coming up, very much like this Boeing deal, come up with a bunch of tax breaks for Boeing, save union jobs, build a whole bunch of roads, and erode environmental protections. I think what's happening is people look at that model, and it doesn't work from either perspective anymore. It doesn't work from the perspective of throwing money around, because there isn't the money to throw around on the part of the taxpayers and the federal government. And it also doesn't work from an ethical standpoint in terms of who benefits at the other end. And I think that like this roads package they're talking about in Olympia. Mass transit? Are you kidding? It's barely even in any transit's barely in there. It's road projects. And I think that this is where, whether you agree with Sawant's socialism or not, where she's articulating a different perspective. It's not an accident that she's suggesting that if Boeing leaves, you turn those machinist plants into mass transit manufacturing plants. It's connected. It's work that is the work we should be doing in the future, as opposed to trying to make these models from the past work.
It also seems that at the moment we're in the rhetorical phase of this. We're talking about the big concepts, and come January, Councilmember Sawant will have to sit down, even though that's not her favorite thing to do, with her fellow council members and join a committee, lead a committee, get council assignments, and we'll sort of get into the more practical nitty-gritty of what her election is. I mean, she's fascinating. Everybody's wrapped up in it. But think about this. They all have to run in 2 years under the new change. And so she can't get too wild, or she will or she won't have that opportunity next time.
Well, you know, she talked when she was running at a time of budget cuts. City council members pay themselves $120,000 a year. If elected, I'll only take the average worker's wage, donate the rest to building social movements. And then The Stranger, your newspaper, wrote about, quoted Nick Licata, talking about how it's really important to stick with the facts and not be personal. Is she ready to, from your perception, is she ready to lead the kind of, I mean, you're talking about a vision of the future, which is a different kinds of coalitions, Canute. Do you think she's ready for that? Or are we ready to follow her for that?
Different questions.
Yeah.
Leading a social movement is one thing. Operating as one of nine members in a legislative body is a completely different thing. And so the question is as much, is Shama Sawant ready to navigate that labyrinth, as it is the rest of the city council ready for her? And how are they going to receive her on the council? And what does she place as the higher priority, leading a social movement, which sometimes involves failures, defeats that demonstrate the larger point? In other words, she could be unsuccessful on the council and by doing that succeed in proving to her followers what she has been telling them about the council and its corporate backing and so on. Or does she place ahead of that successful legislative achievements, which will require a different posture from her?
It'll be interesting. What did you make of the article that was in Cairo that said that one of the reasons Sawant may have won is because people who backed the Sonics were angry over Richard Conlon's lack of support for keeping the NBA in Seattle? That's an interesting notion.
Yeah, that was interesting, because you would think on the face of it that she would be against public welfare for billionaires building a Sonics arena. On the other hand, Conlon was a known enemy. He was known to be opposed to the arena, and on record as being so, and wasn't likely to change his mind. She's kind of dodged the issue in the sense that she sort of stood back and said, well, you know, it's not on my watch. It's already happening. It's certainly a better deal than other cities have cut. So I think she doesn't really want to get into the Sonics thing. But for Sonics proponents, that would be, you know, that would be better than the alternative, which was Conlon's reelection.
And they just wanted to punish Richard Conlon for not backing the Sonics.
I think partly that. And also, you know, they probably feel they can make a case with Sawant. And she's, I think she doesn't want to touch it, but she's going to have to. She's going to have to take a position.
Well, the Sonics group was so much fun to watch as it became a political force. I have a hard time getting my mind around them lining up with Sawant. It doesn't make a lot of sense unless she says, sure, have the tax breaks that you have the taxpayers contribute. Unless she goes along, it's going to be a short little party that they have here. But don't forget, that group was already sort of getting together and trying to boost Mike McGinn. And so they probably needed some council people to think they had a chance with.
Green Bay model. The workers own the means of basketball. In this case, the voters.
I thought it was football in Green Bay.
It was, but I mean, we could do that here. She could lead that charge.
That's I was just going to say, that's what I could hear Shama Sawant leading.
Let me stick with two more Seattle issues before we move on to regional and state and national stuff. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW with Joni Balter, Seattle Times, Knute Berger at the Mossback at crosscut.com, author of Pugetopolis, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. The police monitor, was put in charge by the DOJ and the judge to track Seattle Police Department reforms, has been critical of the leadership, except for acting police chief Jim Pugel, for not embracing these reforms. That my reading of it, talking to Steve Miletich from the Times, and just thinking about this is this is actually a little dangerous right now, because we're in a transition time, and the Monitor comes out and says, you're not doing what you said you were going to do.
Well, I think a lot of people, when they read that story, were asking themselves, does this mean, this is just one take on it, does this mean that Jim Pugel cannot be a final candidate for, instead of interim police chief, the long-term police chief? But if you read the story carefully, there was like, an accommodation and actually a compliment paid to Jim Pugel. And so, you know, remember, when the new mayor, Ed Murray, goes out to figure out who his new police chief is, everyone thinks it's this vast pool of people. It is not. It's going to be a very small number of people who can work in a big city, have a sense of reform, understand the diversity of this particular community. And so Pugel sounds like he'll still be in there.
Anything that you guys answer that, and then this question too, anything in Ed Murray's choice for his in law enforcement transition team being somebody who's got ties to Merrick Bob, the Monitor, and has got ties to the Justice Department, Bernard K. Malikian, what does that tell you anything about where we're at in this transition as the Monitor releases this critical statement?
Well, you were asking whether it's a dangerous time to be speaking so bluntly about the pace of change in the police department. And I actually think it is the least dangerous time to be doing it. In a way, it's the best time, the least clouded by political considerations. It's dangerous for Jim Pugel because there's a question of whether he will be seen as dragging his feet or whether people will say, well, the guy just got there. Give him some time to push along reforms. He's okay to bring in as the next police chief to follow this through. So it's dangerous for him. But for everyone else, it's great. There's no politics mucking it up, and you can speak bluntly and truthfully about what needs to be done. And the new mayor is then placed on the hook for seeing that it happens.
I think it's a hugely consequential decision for Murray. I think that, and I think he recognizes that it's his number one priority. It's a big hire. Who you hire as chief can be incredibly important to a mayor's term in office. We have examples of at least one mayor in this city who was recalled because of he appointed essentially a crook as police chief, and this is
probably not a good idea.
Back in 1911, I think he had been police chief for a long time and previously, and. And I think they actually thought it was a very good idea because it was during the tolerance policy days. But, you can get into big trouble if you make a wrong decision there. Murray signaled during the campaign, I think, that he wanted to go beyond Pugel without specifying names. But one of the things he said was, I want somebody who's got experience transforming police departments, you know, that gets the new world. And I think the consultant and the consultant's connections and whatnot suggest you want somebody who's going to be very much someone that the Monitor and the feds will like, and, you know, that's going to be an important part of, in a sense, of the search itself.
And go ahead.
Well, just for the outgoing mayor, Mike McGinn, there was an announcement this week that was kind of interesting for someone who's leaving an effort that's been underway for quite some time called Operation Happy Holidays, which, as you know, some of the complaints about police around here have been that, you know, people don't feel safe downtown, they don't feel safe in Westlake Park, and 31 suspected drug dealers were sort of rounded up there. Just saying.
And overall, before I shift, have you learned anything in this transition time about what kind of mayor Ed Murray is angling to be? Anything at all revealing itself in this early stage?
Well, the committee's pretty darn big. The transition committee, is it 43 or 34? I forget. But
that's a lot of people.
It's a big number. Skip and I were talking earlier about that there's a meeting of that committee. And I
Skip, that's Canute.
That would be Canute. I jokingly said, so where are they meeting at Safeco Field?
He is definitely following through on his promises to convene committees to come toward consensus on things rather than, you know, being what he described as bullheaded and kind of a more forceful executive, other people would say, which is what he said McGinn was doing. At a certain point, I don't think that point is now. Everyone gives people a lot of transition time to get on top of things and think things through. But at a certain point, people are going to want to hear Murray come in and make some decisions on his own.
You know, you mentioned that transportation package before, and it was a package that the Republicans had put out that also has some environmentalists upset. And it is because where they're going to try to fund some of the money from a toxic fund, toxic cleanup fund. And there's the question of very little mass transit and a lot of money for roads. Are we seeing how those guys are going to be operating the next few months?
Well, what I heard yesterday that I thought was very strange was that somehow there's this notion in the legislature that if the legislature doesn't meet, you know, between now and the end of the calendar year, that there won't be enough votes to vote for this package because people will be up for re-election, which I don't get the big difference between December and January. I mean, you're still voting for this big package, and it's still on your record, and it still can go on a mailer. So that lost me.
Well, the other thing that I find interesting is, and I'm just bringing it together, but, you know, Knut, you started earlier talking about, like, are we going to see this emergence of different coalitions and different concepts? I think the story of Susan Hutchison, the new chair of the state Republican Party, getting $20,000 less than her predecessor earned. She says the pay cut defies the concept of equal pay for equal work, playing into the war on women narrative against Republicans. She's basically saying, how can you pay me so much less for the same job? I mean, it seems like just a dumb idea from the outside looking at the Republican Party.
I think she's correct that you can't. How can you do that? How can you say when Kirby Wilbur was here, he's a $95,000 guy, but when Susan Hutchison comes in, let's just trim $20,000 and give her $75,000. So she's right on the point. Some of the wording, or should we say someone at the party, is not her best friend, because to let that kind of wording about the war on women out makes her look counterproductive toward her own party. It was not a good moment for
Hutchison's silence.
Yeah, and let's not forget that her major employer for years was Cairo, and she had a discrimination and pay lawsuit against them, which ended up being settled. But when she ran for county executive in 2009, I think, those court records were unsealed. It, you know, revealed a lot of the insider accusations back and forth. It was a pretty acrimonious situation there. And now she's got this new job and kicking it off with allegations of discrimination. And I think it goes to, one of the questions about Susan Hutchison for a long time has been, is she somebody that her coworkers can get along with well? And already she's kind of off to a rough start. And that's apart from the legitimacy of her, of the issue, as Joni says. I mean, it clearly does seem unfair that there's that pay differential. But the language used, the war on women, and I mean, it was tough language for your new employer. And these are people that you have to work with statewide.
She could always file suit. We did a poll. I did a poll on Slog this morning as to what Hutchison should do about this problem, and filing suit was a leading choice among our readers. So, but it's a really politically dumb thing for the party to do. Setting aside whatever debate there may be about the merits internally, Hutchison is right. This looks bad. Remember, Kirby Wilbur, just the other day, the thing he's most known for recently is calling a bunch of female Democratic protesters for immigration reform witches and hags. So you have the misogynist ex-male leader of the state Republican Party getting paid $95,000, and a woman who comes in and replaces him, well qualified, making $20,000 less, and it really suggests where the party's priorities are, and it's not going to be helpful in terms of doing what she's charged with, which is winning back the mainstream.
Ladies and gentlemen, 53% of the electorate nationally and in the state of Washington are women. The Republican Party has had enough trouble talking about women. So then they go out and they get a female party chair. And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm not always like this, but I'm sitting there thinking, you know, female party chair, maybe the Democrats will have one. They have quite a list of folks. You know, things will maybe settle down, except this is kind of the opposite.
Do you remember all the discussion in the last presidential election of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, and that it was President Obama's first law that he signed as president right after he got reelected, and how resonant that was with the 53% of voters who are women? This essentially, Susan Hutchison has become the Lilly Ledbetter of her party.
Yeah, and considering that most women well understand pay discrimination, she could take that as a banner, and the Republican Party could be leading the charge on
Except
those issues.
She won't, and so she will reinforce, this whole episode will reinforce something that's going to be detrimental, an idea that is not going to help Republicans.
By the way, just to shift here, another former, you know, personality in the news and still working person, Gary Locke, ambassador to China, he's coming back. We don't know what he's going to do. We could wonder about that. But I was struck by the Politico article that came out when Locke announced that he was stepping down. And it was, here's the quote, determined to make something out of his commerce perch, because Locke was commerce secretary first, Locke pressed to be admitted to the big economic team meetings where all the key decisions were being made by the West Wing's A-team players. He attended a few but did little to impress Obama or his team and was eventually shipped off to Beijing as ambassador. He was never heard from again, recalls a former member of the economic team. That's damning information that they're saying happened to Gary.
Well, you know, Politico does seem to have a source that does seem to be saying that Gary wasn't very well regarded. But I remember very clearly when Gary Locke said he was going to become the ambassador to China, making phone calls. So, hello, is this a promotion, demotion, or lateral? Trying to figure that out. And if it had been any other ambassadorship, I was told by several people who seemed to know what was cooking, if it had been any other country ambassadorship, it would have probably been a demotion or a very lateral. But because it was China, and China's so darn important in every way that Gary Locke said as he was leaving, it was viewed as, you know, that's a pretty cool thing to send someone who was the governor of Washington, whose father and grandfather were born in China, to China to represent the United States. And so Politico seems to have some different kind of a source that they weren't so hot about him at Commerce, but the ambassadorship to China was a gem.
All right. I'm going to shift to Washington, D.C., given that we already kind of made our way there by way of Beijing. The Senate Democrats, I love that the phrase is the nuclear option, pressed the trigger on changing the rules of the filibuster in order to get some appointments from the president through on a simple majority rather than have to deal with 60 votes or two-thirds majority. Here's what President Obama had to say why he supported the change.
Over the past 5 years, we've seen an unprecedented pattern of obstruction in Congress that's prevented too much of the American people's business from getting done. It's harmed our economy, and it's been harmful to our democracy. And it's brought us to the point where a simple majority vote no longer seems to be sufficient for anything, even routine business, through what is supposed to be the world's greatest deliberative body.
The world's greatest deliberative body is now changed, and some Republicans are saying, yeah, you just wait. You change the rules. We're gonna come back when we take over the Senate. That's always what they've been saying. Is this a positive or a negative?
Well, it's troubling. Here's the troubling part of it. The troubling part is that all the things that go on in Washington, D.C. seem to be the most the ultimate, you know, here, okay, so we're not getting along, so we'll shut down the government, or we're not getting along, so, you know, we'll go over the cliff. Just a bunch of things that just sort of bring us to further brinkmanship. The frustration is palpable, it's real, it's understandable. They didn't exactly do the full-on nuclear option, which would have gotten rid of the filibuster for legislation as well, which they did not do. That's a big difference. But the warning that you might experience this from the wrong end sooner than you think, to me, was captured in, I think it was a New York Times story this week that talked about how the Republicans are already gearing up to swat some politicians around about health care.
Well, that's for sure going to happen.
That
right?
is for sure.
That
yes.
seems to be happening.
I think the context here is important. There was a graph that went around, I think, from the Washington Post that showed in all of American history, it showed the filibuster of presidential appointments throughout all of American history compared to the filibustering of routine presidential appointments under President Obama. And there were very close to an equal amount of filibusters in each category. In other words, the Republicans have filibustered more routine appointments in the last 6 years, am I adding years right? The last years under Obama than anyone has for all of American history. And so something has to be done. And what the Republicans are complaining about at the moment is their ability to block routine business.
If you have rules that are designed to have better deliberation because there's more compromise, there's more discussion, that's one thing. If you use those rules to completely obstruct, that's another thing. And I think a lot of people feel that the president ought to be able to appoint his or her people. And that means judges. That means people to various departments, and that should not be a process where, and you had Mitch McConnell came out and said his primary agenda was to stop Obama, to stop his everything, and that's what they've done. And I think the idea that in terms of the long term thing, there will be a reaction to it if the Republicans get control of the Senate. they're not going to go back to the pre-nuclear era. I mean, does anybody think they're going to go, no, the way we had it before was right, we're going to give the minority that power? No, they're not. So, I think they did the right thing here, but it won't be without consequence.
By the way, just on the notion of how this relates to how they'll discuss health care and how people beat up certain people about health care, here's what Mitch McConnell said during the debate.
He may as just as well have said, if you like the rules of the Senate, you can keep them. Huh? If you like the rules of the Senate, you can keep them.
See, he's just joyful about that, Mitch McConnell. Something about that works for him.
Yeah, that he did the thing that people who are really unfunny do, who they make a statement that's not funny, and then they repeat it to make sure that you knew it was supposed to be funny.
Yeah, a joke has to go one round only.
Can someone tell me what the Republican leadership in D.C. is up to lately other than trying to take things apart and block things? I mean, this is...
I'm sure there are people that can tell you.
Well, I would like to hear it. They are gleeful, and you hear this in McConnell's statement about wanting to slowly, bit by bit, tear down Obamacare. They are gleeful about wanting to block every presidential appointment they can. They were really revved up to take the economy to the brink of ruin, essentially, with the last fiscal standoff. But what is their positive program for improving the lot of Americans who need some help?
You know what? You know who's going to tell us that? The people who are going to write us weekinreview@kuow.org, or use the Twitter with the new hashtag that we're going to debut now, and I hope people will use since this is Week in Review, hashtag review this. We're on the Week in Review with Joni Balter, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, 11/22/2013. Everybody's talking about where they were when JFK died. Everybody in the media is talking about this. There was an amazing American Masters, American Experience, rather, on KCTS from public television. I saw it on KCTS. About the Kennedy, maybe, that we didn't know so well, especially how sick he was, how he dealt with his issues, how political he was. What are there themes emerging from all this conversation about JFK today?
Well, one of the themes I found interesting was in one of the stories I read. They called the assassination the decade detonator. And if you think about it, that was the first really, just shocking event that happened in that decade. And it was followed by two more assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And so to think that one event, as bad as it was, and you saw all the tears and all the reactions, But then it was like the trigger in some way for what would follow. And I think for millennials, you know, obviously 9/11 was their event like that. So that's what I was struck by the most.
What have you been struck by, Knut? You, me, and Joni, we all are of the era. We remember where we were.
Right.
So what were you struck by in terms of themes emerging?
Well, it's interesting because there's an easy way to dismiss the kind of obsessive coverage of it as kind of boomer nostalgia and that kind of thing. But the Kennedy assassination was our 9/11. I mean, we had 9/11 too. But it was and then, as Joni says, you know, followed by the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, there was a huge, if you think of that time period, and even as a child, I was aware of this, that these were people who were young. They were expressing great hope and great optimism about the future. And suddenly they were removed from the scene violently. You know, I think it shaped a lot of our. I think a lot of people feel we've been in a kind of a dark time ever since. That we've struggled. That there was a way that we, coming out of World War II and the Kennedy era, we were looking to space, and that there was this real positive projection, and that somehow after that it became a series of, you know, Watergate, impeachments. And the voices silenced. And, you know, I mean, we have a very, I think anybody who's read about Kennedy would have a very nuanced view of, you know, whether he was a good president or not and a lot of things. But he articulated something about a time that I think many people profoundly miss.
I think the interesting contrast between the articulation, the language that he used and how he presented himself. And yeah, whether he followed through on policies, whether he had core beliefs that he stood behind, and what kind of president he was.
So, in the contrast to the nihilism that we see in D.C. today.
So what themes emerge from you? Because you are not somebody who lived through Kennedy's assassination.
Right.
You just get the boomer nostalgia about it.
I get a heavy dose of boomer nostalgia. And oddly, and I don't think people think about this enough, I get politicians marketed to me, and anyone younger than me gets this also, as the next Kennedy, as if I have a memory of what Kennedy was. But I know what he means and what he is a signifier for in the culture, and that is exactly what you're saying, idealism, optimism, hopefulness, a sense that America can do better. And so when a Clinton or an Obama tries to grab the mantle of Kennedy, I get what's going on. But he exists for me as a symbol that is constantly invoked in my life, but obviously not as a real memory.
I thought it was interesting that Pew tracking poll, tracking preferences among different age cohorts and the presidential legacies, how generations have voted. The boomer generation that came of age during Kennedy and went on to be voting with Nixon and Ford, Carter and Reagan. Boomer generation, mostly voting Republican.
You know, this is a debate I had actually with my husband about this, because we were talking about demographics and how it was going to change, how it was changing throughout the country. And I argued that boomers are doing what every other generation has done before, which is get a little more conservative as they get older. And we had quite a debate about this, because he didn't agree with me, and he said that I didn't back it up with any evidence. But thank you.
I think the boomer generation was always more conservative than the pop culture image. Majority of 18-year-olds voted for Richard Nixon in 1972. And I think you see that in our politics. I think some of the obstructionism, the Tea Partyism, I think certain the Newt Gingrich, you see certain elements of boomer rebellion expressed in conservative politics and the suspicion of institutions. So I think the idea that the 60s, the only legacy of the 60s was kind of boomer nostalgia for Camelot is really wrong. There's a lot of boomer nostalgia for Barry Goldwater.
Another thing that Another thing that President Obama's first campaign successfully tapped into is the exhaustion with the 60s having never ended, essentially. And with all, as Knut's alluding to, everything today being a refighting of things that were fought about but never settled in the 60s, there is a large contingent of the electorate that is moved by a politician who can, you know, on the one hand, say he embodies some of the real positive ideals of Kennedy and the Kennedy era, but on the other hand, is really ready to move beyond the fights that we've been having ever since in all kinds of different forms.
223.3 million Americans are too young to remember the JFK assassination. 90.6 million can remember. It's an interesting statistic. All right. Joni Balter is with the Seattle Times. Knut Berger is at crosscut.com, where he writes the Mossback column, also at Seattle Magazine. And Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. We want to hear from you. Write us, Week in Review at kuow.org. Tweet us at Review This. Review This. Think of it that way. We'll be off next week. We'll give thanks to our friends and family. But don't forget to listen to us on the record for the Week in Review Extra on Fridays. Thank you, guys.